the patrol goes into isolation, so no one else knows what's going on. And any information you need is brought to you, like, you know, imagery, you know, satellite imagery, any of that sort of stuff. So what happens? The whole patrol sit down and everybody's encouraged to come up with their ideas. And because you're in that bubble, you can come up, you're encouraged to come up with a load of old crap. It doesn't matter because it'll bounce out a different idea or a better idea. And you can criticize each other because it doesn't go anywhere, because everybody understands that it's got to be a success, whether it's a physical success or it's a success because we all come back alive. Everybody can give their tuppence worth in, and you start developing a plan. But there is a time when the patrol commander goes, right, this is what we're going to do. And it could be something that hasn't got any ideas from the rest of the patrol. But that doesn't matter, because the patrol understands there must be a plan, there must be a leader, there must be a time where you just shut up and accept what's going to happen. So and you get on with the job. Now, after the job, when you go into debrief, you can go, well, what we did was a load of crap because this, that, and that. What we should have done is this. But it's done in the forum of, as I've spoken before, where people are coming together to try and make it better next time for other people.
Hello there and a very warm welcome or welcome back to the podcast. My name is Steve Ingham. I'm an applied scientist and leader from the world of high performance sport. And on the podcast, I explore all aspects of human performance, whether that is getting stronger, fitter, mentally more prepared, eating better, playing better, leading and coaching in different ways, but also how we perform in work individually and as teams. And the way I do that is by speaking with great scientists, practitioners, researchers, coaches, athletes, and entrepreneurs. I'm also keen to talk to people from outside of sports, people who are just interested in how we perform as humans. If you enjoy the podcast, then please do share it with friends and colleagues and be sure to subscribe. And if you want to support and champion us, then please do leave a review on iTunes. This week's guest is Andy McNabb. So Andy is perhaps the most recognisable name of any special forces operator in the world. Andy served in the Royal Green Jackets in Northern Ireland, where he was awarded the Military Medal for Gallantry. And he entered the Special Air Services in 1984 and worked on both covert and overt operations, including counter-terrorism and drug operations in the Middle East, Far East, South and Central America and Northern Ireland. Andy is perhaps best known for commanding an 8-man SAS patrol designated Bravo 20 in Iraq, which he wrote about in the book bearing the same name. In the book, he tells of a mission that was compromised and that actually led to 3 of the 8 dying and 4, including Andy, being captured, held and tortured for 6 weeks. I wanted to talk to Andy about his choices to join the military, what selection felt like for the Special Forces, and what qualities they were selected for. And Andy, as you'd expect, tells it like it is. There is a clarity of understanding about what is required, how you undertake highly specialized maneuvers, and how you achieve high performance under the intensity of combat. But this isn't all just aggression and attack, although there's a bit of that. Listen carefully and you'll hear a profound lesson in how you select people, how you train people to perform, and how you deliver when it matters. We also discuss the finding that Andy is a diagnosed psychopath, or more specifically, a functioning psychopath, how he found out, what that meant for his military performance, as well as how understanding that has helped him engage more effectively in day-to-day life. Using emojis, it'll all become clear in a minute. It was an honour to speak to Andy. Not everything in Special Forces applies to our sporting and working lives, but here are some super interesting insights in this conversation, of which I have no doubt you could apply. And it certainly offers a contrast. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Andy, what a pleasure to welcome you onto the podcast. What a true treat. How are you?
I'm very well. All good. Bit wet and miserable down here, but all good.
I'd say it's good to see you, which probably isn't relevant for people listening. But equally, I can see you, but we're going to blur your face out for the video. But no, that's not a gimmick, is it, Andy? There's a real substance behind that.
No, it's
staying
not.
Anonymous.
No, it's not. It's basically because of the some of the operations that was involved in during the time in the Special Air Service, particularly to do with Northern Ireland, and because I worked as an undercover operator for 2 years living in Derry, which is the second city in Northern Ireland. And the problem that I've got is showing my face not only puts myself in danger after those sort of operations, certainly people that still live there, you know, particularly in sort of the special branch that obviously they live in Northern Ireland themselves. So it's really being protective about that. And, you know, I get death threats. The last serious one, you get the fruits, you know, all that sort of stuff. But the last serious one was 2 Octobers ago.
Right.
So, it's just being sensible. That's all.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Now, look, you've done some truly incredible, unimaginable things for a lot of people, frightening potentially and distressing. And you're incredibly successful as a writer, communicating what it's like being in the Special Forces. But you're one of the few people who've chosen to be trained and needing to perform in those most dangerous situations. What's contributed to you having the capability and the capacity to confront dangerous situations and perform at that level?
I think it was, certainly it was the, I served 8 years in the infantry before I done, and then served 10 years in Special Air Service. I think being in the infantry helped quite a lot, as in, if you like, pre-conditioning, if you like. Okay. You know, if you're looking at hardships, that all that sort of stuff, you know, that we read. Well, I was basically in care until I was five. Then I was adopted. I lived in an housing estate. Then I joined then landed up in juvenile detention. Then I landed up in the army. So, if you like, the physical hardships are not too much of a problem, because you're used to, like, you know, being wet, cold and hungry and, you know, I don't know, getting beaten up on Saturday night, trying to protect your kebab from somebody trying to nick it in a garrison town. You know, all that sort of stuff. So it seemed a natural progression to move into what we call UKSF, United Kingdom Special Forces, Special Air Service. After 8 years thinking, I thought this was all right. I quite like this. And, you know, the reward of being in Special Forces is a lot better, whether it's a monetary reward or even being able to get more on different styles of, well, you know, we don't call them missions. They're called jobs. You know, everything's sort of pushed down a bit rather than elevate all the excitement. So you get a lot more exposure to different types of jobs. And in fact, one of them we just spoken about, you know, we're landing up doing an undercover operation for 2 years. So that was for me the reason for trying for the Special Air Service, because it's a selection process. So there's normally there's about 200 at tops, about 220 people go on each selection. There's two a year, and it's nothing to do with anything else but apart from health and safety, trying to manage that group of people up in the Black Mountains and the Brecon Beacon, right, running around. And out of that, between 8 and 12 get in the final after the 7 month selection. But I thought, well, give it a go. You know, if you fail, you fail. If you get in, you get in, and that's it. So just give it a go and see what happens.
So there was a exposure in your standard military, and then did you have a sense, but other than the pay and the quality of the jobs, as you term it, was there an additional level of performance that you were attracted to?
Yeah. Well, there is. There's this term, the spanning around the pursuit of excellence. So within a military context, it's really putting it, first of all, it's putting it into a context that it's just as valid career as anything else. quite frankly. Yeah. You know, we find it sometimes slightly uncomfortable that there's people, men and women, who like to fight. It's as simple as that. Until we want them to do that, of course, then that all changes. You know, liberal democracy, we find it slightly uncomfortable, but there is a population that likes to do that. I like the, you know, not the, in that bravado sense of running around, you know, screaming and shouting and all that sort of business. But actually, as a business, of violence, it's an application. It's not like being violent. It's the application of violence. Cause 9 out of 10 times you don't want to be violent. Because actually, you might lose. You know what I mean? It's like the reality is, it's not a TV film. You might lose. So it's the application of violence that I find attractive in that context.
Yeah. Okay. So I remember British Taekwondo, putting together a talent ID program, and there's lots of, I would say, over-intelligent discussion about the physical qualities that are required. Yeah. We want certain limb length. We want a certain power output. We want endurance. We want the ability to cope with heat. And one of the fighters, players, as they're called, said, "Yeah, but you've got to remember, one of the key qualities is that they like kicking each other in the head."
Exactly. It's like they like to fight. You know what I mean? It's and I think we get so academic in things. But it's like any organization, you know, as it gets bigger, there's more bureaucracy, it's more corporate, it's more, you know, then you've got this body, that body, and, you know, you've got all that sort of stuff. And sometimes as the further that sort of corporate mentality goes up, you lose the essence of what they're trying to achieve in the first place, which is good, certainly within special forces, because they do conduct their own selection process. And the requirements come from what they call the saber squadrons, the four squadrons that fight. So because obviously everything's, you know, constantly evolves like any other business. Things evolve, different environments, different sort of situations. So the if you like, there's the fundamental basis of the selection. And that's predominantly stamina and aptitude, the aptitude to learn more than anything else. Stamina and aptitude, and once you're fulfilling those requirements during the selection process, what, if you like, the modules of the things that you're learning, and if you're capable of learning them anyway because you've got the aptitude to learn, are coming from the squadron. So soon as you get into a Sabre squadron, you're on a probation for a year, but it's not necessarily you're just sitting back. You might be going straight on operations, which in fact, you know, I joined my squadron on a Tuesday, and then on Thursday I was flying out to Southeast Asia on an operation. They were already there. So you've got to be able to slot in straight away and then pick up what's going on. So that's why the requirement comes from the squadron. So we're very lucky in that way, because this, if you like, the corporate mentality sort of, yeah, is there. Don't get me wrong, it's there the further up you get, certainly within the military management. But it's if you like, it's ring-fencing the selection process. And say, well, we'll soon know if we got it wrong, because everybody's like cocking up, you know, or getting killed. So that process works pretty well, actually. And it's the thing about it is that you never know how good or bad you're performing, apart from at different stages. There's four major stages of the 7-month process where people then, you know, are constantly sort of weeded out. But you never know how good or bad you're doing, because it's all about best effort. Again, this pursuit of excellence and the best effort. And then, you know, you can have like the best soldiers on the planet, but they need direction. So if they're told, right, you know, run up that hill, they'll keep on running until somebody says they'll stop. But you don't want that. You want somebody who's able to think for themselves, because they've got to make decisions for themselves once they're on the ground. Because there is no element of that command to tell you what to do, because by definition of your work, you're out there without support, without any sort of guidance, and you've got to get on with, you know, if you like, the mission statement, because nothing else matters apart from, you know, the sentence, the mission, the reason why you're doing what you're doing, which we'll talk about later on, how you you know, are you focused on that? But so it's that sort of, you know, aptitude to learn and stamina. And you just carry on your best efforts. That a lot of people find very difficult because they want accreditation, or they want some, you know, accreditation that they're doing well, or what they want is this sort of, you know, come on, lads, it's, you know, if you do this, it'll be all right. You know, that sort of trying to help you along. And the argument about selection is, well, you know, once you get out in the field, there's no one's going to help you get along anyway. So if you can't do it, you can't do it. It's as simple as that. So you're out.
Okay, so there's a bunch of things in there that I'd love to ask you about.
Yeah.
Let me just pause, because that idea about the improvisation, let's come back to that one, because I'd love to get into that, because that I think that is such an interesting concept, rather than training somebody where you're coaching them and giving them instruction from the sidelines. I'll park that one for the moment. So stamina and aptitude, and am I right in thinking that it was your second attempt to pass?
The first attempt, I was far too confident, far too cocky. And I got to the second last day, and of the first month, which is the selection, the rest is continuation training. Most of the people go in that first month, you know, they normally down, or my selection was down from 220 down to 24. And that's the if you like, the group, the cadre that you know, carry on with. But I got the second last day of that, and I thought I knew where I was going on one of these, what they call TABs, you know, tactical advanced battle. Basically, you got a backpack on, and you get a day's weight, anything between 35 and 62 pounds. You've got to carry a weapon, and you're doing these navigational sort of marches on your own. You know, it's just getting one foot in front of the other as quick as you can. And I took a shortcut, being cocky, because I thought I got it right. And what it was a long cut. So I thought it was a fire break in the forest, a forestry fire break. But what it was, they just cut the trees down, so they hadn't pulled them out yet. So I was like climbing over, so I was late. So you get two goes on selection, and you can't reapply after that, because you might take up the place of a candidate that could, you know, could pass. So it's up to them whether they invite you back for a second one. And I said, well, you want to go for a second one? Well, yeah, of course. So I got back on the, fortunately, there was a space on the next selection, because sometimes you're waiting a couple of years, you know, because of the amount of candidates that apply. But I got on to the next one, and that one I passed.
And so was that you checking yourself and reflecting, okay, no shortcuts?
Yeah.
Follow the process.
It's just too confident. It's too confident. Because you read it on the map, there's a fire break, and I knew the area anyway. I said, right, I'll crack on through the fire break and it'll be better. So then soon you got committed to the fire break at the carry, you know, and literally just climbing over the, you know, the felled trees, you know, I hadn't been cleared. So I knew, well, certainly towards the end, when I was getting to the final checkpoint, I thought, like, timings are not good on this. But as I was getting through the fire break, I was still feeling quite confident. I thought, well, just got to crack on and push through and see how it happens at the end. But the timings were about 3/4 hour out of. Normally, that it's called sketch map, and that's normally about 9 or 10 hour tab, you know, forced march. But I was about 3/4 hour out, because the day's timing is set by the Special Air Service training team. So what they do, they go out and do the routes that day, because obviously different conditions, if the snow's down or the, you know, the fog's down, and then they set the time for that day. So they're out there setting that time. So I was, you know, about 45 minutes out of their set time. So that was it. So, but thankfully they asked me to come back. So, you know, and the second one, you know, again, no shortcuts, just get on with it. And I knew, you know, I knew I was fit enough to get through that bit anyway. So it was just a matter of just, you know, cracking on, really.
So no feedback during the process.
No.
But tap on the shoulder, sorry, that's it for this occasion. No feedback at that point either.
No.
If you come back again, do this differently.
No. No. Right. So basically it says, like, you know, the timing weren't good enough. However, do you want to try again? Again, because their point of view, if they've got a candidate that's on a second to last day, you've got the finance of actually getting that guy through that first month anyway. There is potential there. So therefore, let's say, right, we'll just give him another go. If it was somebody who'd done that on like a bad timing, say on week one, they'd just be binned straight away. They'd just RTU'd, return to unit, because it isn't worth the effort of taking up a space on a second selection. So it was just a matter of going, right, well, basically I cocked up there because I knew what I'd done wrong. There's no shortcuts, just get on with it.
And so can you describe selection?
I'm
asking as much as anything because I expect many people who might be listening will have a preconceived idea of it based on various TV programs,
They're more or less based on like Japanese endurance programs rather than selection.
But the Clive James ones with worms on your back.
So it's nothing like that at all. So basically, it's a 7-month process. There's all this fantasy about like you're selected to go on selection and all that. No, it's really, really boring. You go to your unit's administration office and you fill in a form to apply for selection. Simple as that. You get your joining instructions. Again, you might have to wait 18 months, 2 years. If your unit's on operations, you can't go whilst you're on operations, all that sort of stuff. So you might have to wait for 2 years. But that's all right. So you just, if you're committed enough, you just get training now and get on with it. So you arrive for the first month. And basically the first month is all about getting yourself over the Brecon Beacons of the Black Mountains in Wales. And every day you'll do what I call TAB, tactical advance to battle, but basically it's just you've got a backpack on, a Bergen, a rifle, and you don't know the route, you don't know the cutoff time, because that's all part of your best efforts. And so you get dropped off, and then what I call the DS, the training team, one of the trainers, go, where are you? You show them on a map. I say, right, go to a 8-figure grid reference that's down to 10 square meter point on the ground. And so you do your bearing. It's all map and compass. And you do your bearings and they say, right, which way are you going? You go that way. And I go, well, you better get on with it then. And off you go. So it's then you've got to, it's navigation and moving as quickly as you can because you don't know the cutoff time. And again, you it's between £35 and £62 that you carry on your back with a weapon. And then during those tabs, you'll get to a checkpoint and they'll check you. They'll weigh the Bergen, make sure everything's all right. So you just bounce from checkpoint to checkpoint, not knowing how long that day's tab is, not knowing what the cutoff time is. And even when you get in, they don't tell you. You get on a wagon. So then what happens is when you get back to Hereford, the base of the Special Air Service, and you're sorting yourself out, having a shower, all that, basically, there's names that are shouted out to go and see the training major, the guy in charge of the selection process. And after a couple of days, you realize they're the lads who are getting thrown out, and they immediately leave that night and they're gone. So day after day, you cut through on that first month. So in my selection, 220, we're down to 24. The next bit you're doing is a lot of weapon training and, to learn about the weapon systems that special forces are using. So, for instance, we had a Marine, Royal Marine corporal who was binned during that 2-week process, because a way that he adapted to the weapon systems, which are quite technical, no matter what, certainly sort of a lot of standoff weapons are quite technical with technology to them. And he just couldn't get it. He just couldn't get it in time. Whereas you'll get a guy from one of the corps, like an engineer ordnance corps, who's technically sort of minded, and they'll stay on that process, because they can learn what the regiment, or the Special Air Service called the regiment within, internally. Well, the regiment will teach him. So we lost the Royal Marine Corporal during that time, which you would expect him to be brilliant, but he was with what he knew. But he found it very hard learning what he needed to know in a short period of time. So lots of different weapon training. And then you go into the jungle for a month Literally, you go in day one, come out day 31, and you're working in small little teams, little four-man teams. And each team has got a DS, you know, one of the training team. They don't live with you. They're apart from that. But everything you do there is with live ammunition. And so you do all the close combat drills, lots of jungle navigation, living in the jungle as well. I'd never been there before. And as well as you learning to see if you can adapt to the way that Special Air Service works with no direction, with no immediate command. You know, it's all about you four getting on with what you've got to do. Seeing if you can adapt to that, and also like understand your integrity, the patrol's integrity depends on everybody chipping in, no matter what, you know, everybody helping each other. And some people cannot actually work in a claustrophobic environment like the jungle, you know, or whether it's to do with getting eaten by everything all the time, or being you know hot and sweaty all the time, all that sort of stuff. So some people haven't got the aptitude for that. Some people haven't got the aptitude to actually work in an individual team. And people have been killed during that selection process, because the argument is you've got to make training realistic.
Yeah, okay.
Because you've got a duty of care for, you know, literally same, you know, what I did. Joined the squadron on Tuesday. Thursday, I was back in the jungle. So there's a duty of care to make sure you can do what they need you to do.
So that's an interesting one. Can I just ask you a little bit about that? Because I suppose that's the old adage or the military saying about hard training, easy combat.
Easy training, hard combat.
But equally interesting to hear the words you're choosing there, the duty of care, about an ethical responsibility that if we don't prep you for that, then throwing you into that will be very much unprepared. Lions then an increase in intensity.
Yeah, but there's also the added thing of that you're putting the people that are already there in danger.
Yeah.
So there is okay. So what they're looking at, the criteria of the training team, the directional staff, DS, whatever you want to call them, is there's a democracy on whether you pass or fail different stages. It's not a total democracy, of course, but the vast majority of it is that the DS get together after that jungle phase, and they go, right, would you have McNab in your patrol? Because most of them are corporals and sergeants who come from the Sabre squadrons. They do their 2 years as a member of the training team, then they'll go back. So the reality is, if you let them through, they might be a member in their patrol, putting their own lives at risk. So what happens is that there's a majority sort of discussion. They go, yep, no. You know, then they bang it out. So there's a reality of the training team are not just ticking boxes, because actually they go back to their Sabre squadrons. You know, they might have a complete dickhead they let go through in their own patrol that gets them or someone else in the patrol killed. So again, that goes back to the duty of care, not only of the individual, but the people that they're going to join.
Mm. And whilst you're going to that process, I presume that the first bit is about, you know, can you hack it? The qualities of physical ability, but also persistence and enduring, as opposed to classic endurance.
Yeah.
But is there a switch then in terms of the intensity of focus that you're having to demonstrate, or that's required when you're going from, I presume, simulation to live rounds? There's, you know, that's, you know, I don't know what the parallel would be in, say, in sport, but it might be training venue to, it sounds a bit twee actually, training venue to 80,000 people watching.
Yeah. No. I'm sure it's the same emotion. I'm sure. It's that, the you know, certainly training with live ammunition, and it really does work. Everything within UKSF is done with live ammunition. You know, there's all these words, you know, the killing houses and all that. They do exist. And you know, people have been sort of injured and killed whilst training in those environments as well. And it's the same argument as well, you know, because it's pointless training for training's sake. You know, you've got to train as realistically as possible. But what it, after a while, you become I suppose it is a blasé. It's like, it's just there, you know, because really? You're doing it all the time. Even to the point of, say, for the use of explosives. So there's a lot of explosives and different devices that you use for whether you're blowing yourself into an aircraft or blowing indoors and all that. And the way that, if you like, the tactics work is that you've got to be right on top of the explosives. Because it's pointless having the bang and then you go in a minute later. You've got to go in. Same as a flashbang. You've got to go in at the same time as the flashbang goes in because that's the distraction. So literally, you can be right up close to the explosives. And, you know, the first time you're doing it, you're sort of, oh, okay, like, and you're, you know, you're facing away. You open your mouth so the pressure wave doesn't, you know, have a go at your teeth, all that sort of stuff. And then after a while, you're slapping it on, shout clear, and you just do it. You know, just do it. And sometimes you get a bit of bristance hitting your face and all that. And that's even in training. And then what happens is that when you then go to do it on operations, you are better prepared because you'll be going to be doing that anyway because you want to get right on top of it. So being sort of the repetition without a doubt helps, and which I'm sure is the same as in sport. The repetition helps. There's a point where you're getting blasé, and basically everything like that is like, fuck it. You know what I mean? It's the argument is you're a volunteer. Nobody is forcing you to do this. So if you don't like it, get out. It's as simple as that. That's if you like the not the ethos or the, you know, thing, but that's the general feeling about thing. So the realistic training really, really helps when you go on ops, because there is that, you know, again, that old adage, you know, it's sort of train hard, fight easy. You know, train easy. Well, you're going to die. You know, so there's which sometimes leads to, again, certainly in training, people getting accidentally shot, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, everything does stop. Have a look at it, a reassess, and think, well, actually, no, it is worth it. It is worth it in the long run.
So that sense of normalizing something quite abnormal. Well, and how did you respond in those situations, or what was the variety of responses that you saw amongst your comrades there? In that sense of, you know, typically in a stressful situation, we have a stress-based response: fight, flight, freeze.
Yeah.
What happened for you, and were you able to then start to overcome that? Was it something it just didn't really register? You're able to push through, or it was a simple version of fight and flight?
Yeah, it's a mixture, really, depending what was going on. I think that whole thing of fuck it, for me, it's always been there anyway. Even when I was a kid, it was like, and look, I always knew that no matter what, it'd be all right. You know, so I realized if I was, you know, I was in trouble, I'll get 96% out of it. It'll be all right. You know, everything will be all right. So it's like, why bother about it, sort of thing. Even during the time in the infantry, was very much the same. You know, it's the first time I sort of, you know, killed someone. I was 19, so I was a 19-year-old kid, basically. I wasn't even shaving properly. So that whole thing of shooting and getting shot at was quite. Not an everyday occurrence, but it was like, you know what I mean? I was just very glad that, you know, certainly on those first contacts that, you know, that lad got killed instead of me. It's not as if you sort of going in a, again, that word blasé way of, yeah, this is great. Cause it's not, cause you're trying to, not all the time, but, you know, 9 out of 10 times you're in a contact, you're trying to kill them before they kill you. So it's just a matter of getting on with it, quite frankly. And there's this, you know, well, I've already used it without really thinking about it. This whole thing, crack on. You just got to get on. You're in the situation. There's nothing you can do about it. You're there. It's pointless moaning about it. It's pointless crying about it. It's pointless being worried about it. Just get on with it. And again, if you don't like it, well, get out. Nobody's forcing you to do it. So it's the fact of actually getting on with it, a sense of satisfaction, bizarrely, at the end, nothing to do with whether it involved, you know, killing people. A lot of the time is, you know, the military use this word kinetic, which basically means killing people and blowing things up. So the fact of being involved in kinetic operations, there is a satisfaction in that, that even if it wasn't successful, that at the same time it was a success because no one's dead from, you know, this side of the house. So it's a more pragmatic view, I would say, rather than certainly what you get in the media, where everybody's like all worried about it, and you know, there's this PTSD does exist. Yeah. Bizarrely, the military are more successful in treating it in-house than the general population. There's a less percentage of it than certainly the way it was portrayed during the post 9/11 wars. Because the system is, for them, there's a thing called TAMS, where if young lads are getting involved in a contact, say in Iraq or Afghanistan, what happens immediately, that group start talking about it, and they're allowed to talk within their own little secure bubble. So they can criticize, they can say what was good, what was bad. He was shit, he was good, you know, I've done this, I've done that. They're allowed to talk about it themselves. No one else is allowed to come in because they weren't there. They didn't see, they didn't hear, they didn't feel what they did. So what happens is helps the process, which has really sort of helped with, you know, bringing the certainly at a later date, the cases of post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And this comes from a corporal. You know, corporals are taught this, you know, which are lower section commanders. And then other people can come in, and they help and they do all that. But it's what it is the people who are involved can sit down and talk and then get it done. And when within SF, we've been doing that for years, but not in the sense of post-traumatic stress. What it was about the pursuit of excellence. So when you come back from a job, the people involved in that job will go into debrief.
Yeah.
And no one else is allowed to go into that debrief. And then everybody can say what went well, what went badly, who performed well, who performed crap. And the idea is that if you can do that in an open forum, it's good because you can get the truth out. And because what it's all about is then moving forward to say then to the bigger organization, right, these are the things that need improving. And again, it's that pursuit of excellence. So next time someone goes on that job, hopefully we can improve on that. And that's how we get what's called SOP, standing operation procedures, from cock-ups. There's SOPs that date from the Malaya emergency, you know, in the jungle. There's jungle SOPs that really come from there, from major cock-ups, from patrols, learning by their mistakes. And those SOPs are still with us now because they work. Mm. So... but that can only happen if...
I just wanted to take a little break from the conversation just to let you know about our online courses for applied performance practitioners. So the focus of the course is to support professionals who I would say are in the first 10 years of their career, with the aims of cutting through the noise and providing clarity in your work, focusing on what matters most, and developing the right skills to ensure that you're making an impact. There are 5 routes available: strength and conditioning with course tutor of Nick Grantham, psychology with Chris Marshall and Rebecca Levitt, performance analysis with Dr. Sean Allen, nutrition with Dr. Sophie Killer, and myself leading the physiology route. The course will be delivered through 10 one-hour lessons, and you'll have lifetime access to the courses, plus community access where you can interact with other students, tutors, watch the replays of all the previous Supporting Champions webinars and summit presentations. If this course is for you, then take a look at supportingchampions.co.uk/online course, and all the courses are there and available. So look, we've had amazing feedback about the impact of this course. You can read some of the feedback on the course pages, and we're really excited about working with a new group of applied professionals aiming to take their practice with athletes and coaches to the next level.
It's just the people who are involved.
So I mean, that's fascinating in the sense that PTSD, the P being post,
yeah,
what actually you're doing is processing,
yes,
in the moment or in the immediately moment. Afterwards. So it's not bottled, it's not festered on, it's not rotting in your head. It's also shared. It's a community thing where you're processing it together. So you're accepting it, you're sharing the stresses of it. But it's equally, it's part of the process of improving performance for you next time. So you're learning, but also for the system.
Yeah. Because you're just the small little, you're tip of the spear. So you've got all these other elements that are behind. So there's a lot of processes, whether it's different voice procedures or different processes to get, you know, a bit of ordnance dropped from an aircraft over there rather than over there, you know, all that sort of stuff. So the mistakes that are made or the disjointed lines of communications, which then make cock-ups, they can be all sorted out. And then obviously the duty of care bit is that people are processed, particularly sort of young lads. I'll give you an example. There's I used to, during the post 9/11 wars, I used to go to Iraq and Afghanistan for the Ministry of Defense, doing some advisory stuff to do with infantry battalions. And it was about their operational needs, you know, not the big ticket stuff, but the little stuff squaddies need to make them safer, you know, make them more comfortable. Because the problem with squaddies, you know, if they want it little and green, the time they get it, it's massive and blue, you know, because of the way that the process goes. So there's money that's put aside to get these immediate sort of things that soldiers need, you know, different things for weapons, different sites, that sort of stuff. So it was out, and the battalion that this was in Basra, done what are called strike ops. They're doing house assaults, trying to look for insurgents. And these were being led and coordinated by members of the Special Air Service. So they'll go in, find the targets, mark the targets, bring the lads in, and then we go in. And interestingly, on one of these TAMS things after a contact, where actually one of the battalion were killed, not within that patrol, but a neighbouring patrol, a neighbouring house or something. So they're going through the TAMS, and the guy from the regiment was really, really good, really helpful, because he basically they was talking about what was going on, and obviously you've got all these young squaddies out of the battalion, you know, there's the regiment guy there, you know, and of course every regiment guy is 6'6", 4', what, you know, all that sort of rubbish. So there's this thing about, you know, the Special Air Service. And what he said, it basically went, fuck that, lads, that was a bit fruity. Fruity's like meaning scary. He went, I don't want to do that again. And all of a sudden you see these young lads go, oh, do you know what? It's all right to say they were scared.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it was very, very good. And what happened then, you know, and then the TAMS thing just carried on. Because he said, I could just see it. You know, you get, you know, 18-year-old squaddy. It's quite a traumatic thing when all that stuff starts kicking off. And so I thought we'd just say it and see what happens. And it worked. It worked.
Yeah, so the leader actually role modeling open communication rather than just feeling like it's got to be some sort of ego-based leadership where I'm going to, show you how invulnerable I am.
Yeah, and it can't be that. It can't be that. That's a good word, actually. I'm going to write that down. Eagle-like leadership. It can't be like that, because you basically what you've got is a small group of people, a large group of people, whatever it may be, whatever formation. By definition, they're there to destroy something or to destroy other human beings, and you need them to do things that a lot of the times they really don't want to do, and naturally don't want to do. But certainly sort of young infantry soldiers, of course they don't, you know, they're worried, of course they're worried. So what happens, you've got to get to the point where you've got to get them to do those things, not only to carry out, if you like, the mission statement, which is the most important thing, but also try and keep everybody else alive as well. So what you've got to do, it sounds almost Victorian, you know, lead by example and all that sort of business, but it's true and it works. So what happens is that if you were, you know, if say, for instance, that regiment guy, well, the regiment's guy, he's got to be number one through the door. no matter what, because then everybody else will follow him. He can't be going, someone else go, right, you go in, you know, I'm going to stand back here. He's got to go at number one through the door. It's as simple as that. So there is that leading by example, which gives you the credibility, which gives you the, it gives you that leadership quality as opposed to a management quality, which are two different things. You know, yeah. Most people can manage things, you know, when things are going well, people can manage things very well, you know, but it's when they're all going wrong or it's all happening around them. That's, you know, when you find a lot of managers can't sort of cut it to be the leader to get that final push.
And so you alluded to these teams of four in the jungle where they would form those, retest, and you would be given operations. What are the sorts of qualities that they're looking for from a leadership, I presume, followership, teamship aspect? And what are they looking for from you?
Yeah, it's a number of things. It's whether you can work in an unsupervised group with your mission statement, whatever you're doing for that day, you know, and that's everything from being able to sort of function in those sort of environments. Because if you let yourself get eaten by everything every day, you know, by day four, you're unable to function, you know, you know, your eyes are swollen up because you've been bitten and eaten and, you know, so you've got to learn how to, you know, look after yourself, but obviously check the others with you to make sure they're all right as well. All that sort of stuff. The training element, and again, lots of, you know, live ammunition, live explosives. So you're going through all the different systems that you use, whether it's the way to patrol in a jungle, the way to tactically live, the way to, you know, move to contact, withdraw out of contact, all that sort of stuff, live ammunition, out to blow trees up, out to blow things up in the jungle, that sort of stuff. It's making sure that people have the aggression as well to get through those, because no, you know, obviously, you know, you're not going against a live enemy, but when all that stuff's flying around, you need aggression to push yourself through anyway. And there's a thing which they particularly look at. There's a thing called a fight through. So once you're moving towards something, you're going to take it on, you know, a position, an enemy position and all that. In that instance, you do fit bayonets because everything's all sort of quite close up, and it's seeing your reaction. Well, and there's targets and all that sort of stuff. So you're going through live ammunition and it's just seeing the reaction to see if you're revved up enough. And you actually are attacking those targets with a bayonet. The aggression is there because there is a stage that the only quality you're going to need is aggression. At some stage in that career, the only thing you've got is aggression. So therefore, you've got to make sure that you've got it. Again, to keep yourself alive. And at the same time, because you're keeping the integrity of the patrol, keeping everybody else alive as much as possible as well. Because there's only four of you. And it's not as if by definition of the work, it's not as if you've got loads of backup that's going to be there within like half hour to pick you up. So that all that stuff doesn't sort of exist in that world. So it's seeing you've got that, but also that point of working as a member of the patrol team. There was one of the things you have to be able to do in special forces, communicate anywhere in the world. And the way you do that is through Morse code, because you can use, wire from a fence to build an antenna. So you learn antenna theory. You learn, you know, the ionosphere and E-layer, D-layer, all that sort of stuff, how to bounce signals off the ionosphere. And so everybody, by the end of the jungle phase, has to be able to do 5 words of Morse code per minute, which is the basic requirement. So, and then you move on to it later on. So everyone's got to do that. So there was one guy in my patrol who was an infantry soldier from an infantry battalion signal platoon, and he was up to about 16 words a minute anyway. So what he was happening during the lulls, he'd be sitting there making tea. He didn't have to learn Morse. We're all like trying to learn Morse all the time during any spare minute we got. We've got trying to learn the, you know, all the, what are called the Q codes and all this sort of stuff you got to learn. And he already knew it. So he was laughing, but he failed purely because he didn't get off his ass and start helping the other three of us.
Interesting. Interesting.
And he wasn't told. He wasn't told to get off his ass and all that. And everybody's looking at it. And he said, well, he was just sitting there making tea. You know, and of course he's making tea for all of us, whereas we're sitting there learning. But what he didn't do was say, look, I'll give you a hand. What do you need?
Yeah, okay. So it's I've got an individual ability that is high on the spider graph here. This is exceptional. But what he's not spotting is the average ability is something I could facilitate upwards.
Totally.
He could for the benefit of all of us.
Yeah, even if he sat there and learning these cue codes, it's normally three letters, which mean it gives a statement. So even if he was sitting there making the tea going, well, what's QRK mean? What's the, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, whatever it was, but he'd done nothing. And to tell you the truth, we didn't think about it as well. You know, we just did our own world trying to learn the Morse code. And we knew he was up 16 anyway. So we thought, oh, he's cracked it. But he didn't crack it because the DS saw it. It said, well, you never helped anybody. So at the end of that phase, he was off purely on that.
Yeah. And I bet that was a profound lesson for you all.
Yeah.
In the sense of, I'm not just here for me. I want to survive.
Yeah.
But my commitment to the team and the team goal.
But that's the thing, I think. That, you know, the fact is that, bizarrely, you are there for yourself. But the only way you can fulfill that is to be this team player. Because otherwise it's not going to exist. You know, because otherwise the reason why you're there wouldn't exist. Simply, again, because the sort of work you do, you're given your mission statement and your limits of exploitation, and you get on with it, and that's it. You know, your pathway fell.
Aggression and collaboration don't necessarily always go together, but in that sense of pushing forward, but also together, being critical. That's a quality that's developed. Yeah.
But if you look at sort of that, if you like, the teamwork and you can encompass everything. If you're looking at the leadership by example, that sort of stuff, the aggression and the teamwork. There's a thing, command and control. It's a great military thing. You know, you command everything and you control you control what people carrying out that command. Within that small group, and even in a larger group, say it's a 10-man like rifle section or whatever it is, when the shit hits the fan and you're actually in the fight and you're physically fighting, command and control doesn't exist. What it's all about is command. So going back to that fight through thing, you're fixed bayonets, and once you say go, you have no command whatsoever, because that's when the aggression comes in. And everybody is in their own world, and people fight in pairs and all that sort of stuff. Even that starts to disintegrate. They understand what they've got to do. They're not listening to anything else because they're just focused on what they've got to do because they want to stay alive. The control comes afterwards when you've got to grip those lads. You've got to grip them and bring them back, if you like, to planet Earth. And that is the control bit. And when you lose control, that's when you start hearing all these stories of lads who are cutting off ears and, all this sort of stuff that's gone on. Even the elements, if you're looking at the abuse in Abu Ghraib by the American military, what there is, there's no control, because you've given the command, you've let them go forward, but you've got to grip them because they're in that element of aggression, which is what you want. But then you've got to hone that aggression in, stop it, and then get away quickly, just in case, the next bit you might lose. And so that's that, again, that's that part of that leadership, because they're going to do it. They are going to calm down because you want them to calm down, because they respect you. And deep down, they understand they've got to calm down anyway. So you're in this weird dilemma where you want them to be really aggressive. You want them to stab people, if you take it to the extreme. But at the same time, you've got to stop it, because then it'll get out of control. I'm not too worried about the out of control bit, but it's that, because you've got to move on. You just don't sit there and make a brew of tea and you've got to get away quickly, because there might be a follow up. So it's really gripping that aggression, if you like, command and control.
And do you think that's something that can be taught in the sense that if you don't have feedback during selection and training, or selection, should I say, Do you think it's an innate quality where there is a maneuver that fight through, and then you're looking for people who are then actively looking to calm themselves, yes, or get back to,
yeah,
to processing in a logical thinking brain.
People who
way.
Understand the system. Yeah, you got to understand the system. So you must understand the system. And the system, again, dating back to these what we call SOPs. The fact is, the reason why there's set things that don't change until they are changed is because of cock-ups historically that have been recognized and rectified and say, right, this is what we do to counter that. So what, you know, that the people who understand, going back to even back to this whole thing of you know, in the military, we all address people by rank and yes, sir, no, sir, and salute and all that. In special forces, there's none of that. So it's you know, it's by a Christian name or a nickname. 9 out of 10 times, a nickname or short version of the surname. You know, that normal sort of stuff. So same, you know, the way people dress somebody on a building site. However, if the squadron sergeant major is the most senior non-commissioned officer in the Sabre squadron, goes, mate, what I want you to do is pick that up and take that over there. You're not going to go, yeah, all right, I'll do that in a minute. You go, yeah, all right, because you understand. He's the squadron sergeant major, and he's telling you he wants that bit of kit from there over there, and you'll do it. So people who don't understand that, then don't make the selection process, because the system wouldn't function by it just being, yeah, all right, mate, yeah, I'll do that later on. It doesn't work like that. But the way that the, if you like, the information is transmitted is in a more casual basis. So it's all part of that understanding the system. And part of that is, you know, through the fight through, well, when a patrol commander says, stop, get over there, they'll do it. They'll do it. Because they understand the reason it is like that. It's number one, he's a patrol commander. And you're only there, by the way, by a form of democracy. Because there'd be people in that patrol perfectly adequately could take command of that patrol, because we all come from different environments. And I was an infantry sergeant when I joined, you know, so, you know, I was a platoon sergeant. So lots of people within their past are perfectly capable of taking control. But because of the selection process, getting the people to understand, we all understand there must be someone in command, because otherwise you lose your integrity, you lose your firepower, then you lose your life. So if the commander's going, do that, they'll do it. So even at the, say you're going on a job, planning and preparation stage. So what will happen is the patrol commander will be given his mission, which is very, very short. And it's like, mission to go and blow this up. Mission to go and blow this up, whatever it is. And that is said twice, so there's no gray area. That is the mission. Everything you do evolves around the mission. So what happens? You go into isolation because of operational security. The patrol goes into isolation, so no one else knows what's going on. And any information you need is brought to you, like, you know, imagery, you know, satellite imagery, any of that sort of stuff. So what happens? The whole patrol sit down and everybody's encouraged to come up with their ideas. And because you're in that bubble, you can come up, you're encouraged to come up with a load of old crap. It doesn't matter, because it'll bounce out a different idea or a better idea. And you can criticize each other, because it doesn't go anywhere, because everybody understands that it's got to be a success. Whether it's a physical success or it's a success, because we all come back alive. So everybody can give their tuppence worth in, and you start developing a plan. But there is a time when the patrol commander goes, right, this is what we're going to do. And it could be something that hasn't got any ideas from the rest of the patrol. But that doesn't matter, because the patrol understands there must be a plan, there must be a leader, there must be a time where you just shut up and accept what's going to happen. So, and you get on with the job. Now, after the job, when you go into debrief, you can go, well, what we did was a load of crap, because this, that, and that, what we should have done is this. But it's done in the forum of, as I've spoken before, where people are coming together to try and make it better next time for other people. But there is a time when the patrol commander, even at that slow time stage, makes the decision, right, this is what we're going to do. Everyone goes with a plan, whether they like it or not. because there has to be a plan. There has to be. And everybody has had their tuppence worth in as well. Everyone's given their views on things. So, but now shut up. This is what we're going to do. Again, if you don't like it, get out. When you're on the ground, there's no time for that. So if the patrol commander's going, go left, everyone will go left, whether they agree with it or not, because they understand the system has got to make sure, keep the integrity of the patrol, keep the firepower, so they don't get killed. And they'll do it. And then later on, if we're all dead, nobody knows it's a cock up anyway. So that's all right. But afterwards, if we get back, and it was a cock up and there's been casualties, we can look at the reason why. But everybody understands that there has to be someone in command. And the fact of command is not a science, because there's too many other factors, you know, from the weather or the opposition or the bad information or the bad signals or whatever it is. So all you can do is what you see, what you hear, what you feel, exactly the same as when you're doing in the debrief. And, you know, whether, you know, your experience, your training, all those sort of things, say go left or go forward, fix bayonets, whatever it may be, and they'll do it, and they'll do it. You can argue about it later on.
And I remember going into my first Olympic environment, that was Sydney 2000, and as we got closer and closer, we're getting sort of into execution mode of, yeah, this is what we're going to do, this is the plan. But the brains were going faster and faster of anticipating what's going to be the outcome. And more people I noticed were coming up with ideas, probably because they wanted to be involved or some sort of offshoot behavior of worrying about the result and therefore let's try and change it now. Yeah. And I was like, no, we've done the planning. This is the time to deliver it.
Yeah.
Let's reflect afterwards. And instituting that as a process, we come up with the ideas, then we execute and then we debrief. And it's actually what I mean. Certainly debrief is probably one of the key areas that I see so few people, certainly in most walks of life, neglecting.
Yeah.
Of actually taking the intelligence out of what they've just experienced.
And also they use it just to have a moan at somebody as well, rather than the whole point of a debrief is to improve.
Yeah, but I suppose for sport, it was actually really keeping that delivery bit, the execution bit, nice and clean.
Yeah.
If you've got an idea, that's the time to come up with it.
Yeah.
And if you want to moan and groan and snipe and criticize and undermine people, that's the time to do it, not in the middle of it.
No, absolutely not.
But planning, you know, that sort of all idea of, you know, no plan survives contact with the enemy.
Yeah.
Of once you're passed through selection, how much does that problem solving and improvisation and adaptability to what you're encountering, as you say, the environment or what you thought was going to be there is not there. How much of that is selected for or just developed?
Yeah, no, it's a mixture of both, really. There's a big sort of ranges all through the military, you know, 7 P's, prior planning and preparation prevents piss poor performance. So that gets you to the point where you've accounted for all the problems. During your planning phases, there's always plan B, plan C. There's the what ifs, you know, so they're called actions on, basically. What if? What happens? What if we get there and it's not there? What if the weather changes? What if, you know? So you've got a selection of what ifs. And obviously it doesn't account for everything. And then everything else you go, we're adapt as the situation dictates. It's the big coverall for everything. So what happens is once you're on the ground, 95% of stuff never goes as planned, of course. So there is a lot of, you know, adapting. There is a lot of and sometimes actually improving on the original plan once you're on the ground and you see something. But the thing that never changes, which is part of the selection process, going back to your original question, is the maintenance of the mission statement. So everything you're doing is focused on the mission. So if you're changing off to plan B, it's to get you back onto your mission statement. And the whole emphasis of the selection process is really getting people who, number one, understand that at all costs, the mission, and can focus on it. And again, you know, the stamina, the hardships, the whatever it is, you know, you think you're going to be on the ground for a week, or you're there for 3 weeks because you was waiting for arrive hasn't arrived. So you wait there for it. You know, it's because that's the mission, to destroy it or to do whatever you're doing. So selection process is very helpful on that. When you get into the squadron, because it's constantly reinforced. You know, the mission statement is constantly reinforced, whatever the mission be. It just becomes part of what goes on, you know. And the fact is, going back to, you know, the job should be 7 days in the field. However, if it doesn't turn up, it might be 3 weeks, and tough shit. It's 3 weeks. That's it. And that's it. And people go, yeah, it might take 3 weeks as opposed to a week that we planned for. So that means, you know, 3 weeks water, 3 weeks food, 3 weeks of this, whatever it may be. And that's all got to be carried in. So, but you're like, tough shit. And again, if you don't like it, you can, no, slavery's been abolished. It doesn't matter. You know, if you don't like it, you can get out. You know, some people do get out, not on that actually. Some people I've known have got out on moral grounds. They've disagreed with, you know, whatever the government of the day has wanted UKSF to get involved with. They've disagreed with that. And there's no big, you know, there's no sort of big disgrace when they're all thrown out and everything, because they go what's called on the circuit, you know, the private military companies, that sort of stuff, which is all sort of run by ex-members anyway. So there's no big disgrace. They said, well, no, I don't want to do that. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, there's one guy who left just against his religious beliefs. And you go, yeah, well, fair one. Actually, morally, probably one of the most bravest people I know, quite frankly. Because, you know, kids, mortgage, all that stuff that goes on, you know what I mean? He's still got to finance all that. So, you know, he got out.
Now, you've had a bit of a look at your mindset with our common connection, Kevin Dutton, looking at your personality and coming out as a bona fide psychopath. Well, tell me a little bit about how that kind of came about, and what the test sort of showed you.
Yeah. Well, Kevin was doing this research, and it was looking at people who are, you know, in society doing well, who would probably register quite highly on the psychopathic spectrum. And he was looking at people, you know, in law, in medicine, and the military, finance, you know, that bizarre situation where, you know, you can look at, like, functioning psychopaths got us in the 2008 situation. Yet, bizarrely, we need them to get us out of it, sort of thing. You know, it was all that weird, you know, all that weird stuff, you know. So I was looking at hedge funds, guys.
Psychopath salespeople to sell to the world.
To get us out. So, yeah. And one of those groups that I was looking at was looking at the military. So, you know, we met up, and, you know, I'd done he's got some written tests and bits and pieces and all that. And that they were quite high. And he said, well, would you be willing to take some more clinical tests, you know, sort of, you know, rather than just a written test? And I'm like, yeah, okay. And again, one of the things that, I've always done as a kid, and now I understand why. It's go, yeah, why not? Yeah, whatever, you know, just try it and see, you know, see what the benefit is, see what reward I'm getting out of it. And so we went to Essex University. That's where all the machines that go ping were. So we sat down and done a series of almost like therapy sessions, I suppose. You know, there's the, you know, again, first time, you know, I don't know, again, recognizing mum. And then I said, well, I don't know, because I was in a home till I was five. So, you know, and again, was that a traumatic experience, going, I quite liked it, I thought it was all right. You know, and went through, you know, childhood and all that sort of stuff. And then we sat down and went through the machinery. So basically, you're strapped in effect the dentist chair with head skulls on, with different sensors on your eyes and ECGs, all that sort of stuff, and you're subjected to a test that was designed in Miami, which is the gold standard, which are used by legal systems to, you know, where people go, they're criminally insane, you know, you can do these tests. First of all, to make sure that the brain is working in a way where it could justify their claim. So I'd done those tests, and literally they flatlined. And normally on these tests, what you have the technicians, then you have a compliance body that are checking the readings. So what happened, they had to then resit the tests because there was another compliance body that was brought in because they weren't too sure, because the machines were working, but the compliance said it was working. So they said, all right, we'll do it again with another compliance team. The readings were the same. So Dutton's come back and he says, almost apologetically, he was going, I can really, really say you're a psychopath. And it was like a light bulb gone off. So it sort of all makes sense now, you know, because then he was explaining the way that, you know, we look and we think and, you know, look at life, think, all that sort of stuff. And I went back home and I told my wife. And I said, oh, well, and by then she'd known, you know, she'd met Kevin and his wife actually as well. And I said, oh, Kevin says I'm a psychopath. And she's going, well, yeah, what's new? Well, you didn't have to spend a couple of days down there. You know what I mean? And then what they wanted to do was they wanted then to do some work with my wife about how to manage people who are high on the spectrum. And it basically means is that you just, well, she just grips me basically, you know, it's like to the point I get, I might have some here on it. I still, because she prints them out. I've got some here. So what she does, she prints these out, cuts them out. Can you see them?
Yeah. Right. So some emoji.
Yeah, emojis.
Characters.
So years and years ago, before I met Kev, what she does, she prints these out and laminates them and cuts them up, folds them and put them in wallet. Because she would go, right, you see this face, you know, a sad face, her sad face. She said, that's that one. So when you see this face, this is what you do. You like make me a cup of tea or you do that sort of stuff.
Oh, right.
So say this face then record, because they couldn't recognize any of the you know, sort of basic emotions. It's never registered at all. You know, I know some people with autism have the same situation, but I didn't realize that, you know, the sort of people who register high on the scale don't recognize those. Which explains a lot when I was in the military, because I've got every gallantry award apart from the Victoria Cross. And so people think, you know, bravery and all that. No, just stupid, because everything is almost like a game, not in a ha 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 sense, but it's like a game. So I go, lads, right, what we're going to do, we're going to go and do this in this way. And I'd never recognize people going, fuck that, you know.
Right.
Because in my head, it didn't seem that as bad as certainly when I was in the infantry battalion, and it was only then through this, you know, about 15 years ago, she started cutting them out, and she, you know, this face, right? This is what you do with this face. This is a happy face. This is a sad one. This is angry. She prints them out, and because I'm always losing them, so she cuts them out, and well, she's, you know, big thick sellotape to almost laminate it, and I put it in my wallet. So it started to make sense.
She's giving you like a bit of a mission yourself. Like, here's a sad face, right?
Exactly.
So we're at base camp one. We need to get up to happy face emoji one. And the plan that you need to deliver that is a cup of tea.
Exactly, a cup of tea. the sad face or the particularly the angry face,
right.
And she goes, right, it's angry face, it's because of something that you've done, you know, and the problem is I wouldn't realize what I've done, what you've done. So what I then started to learn was that you've got to, like, all right, it's an angry face, so what you do, you buy a gift, And do you remember those NutriBullets? I don't know, 5-6 years ago, they were. So every time I cocked up, I'd buy a NutriBullet, and we had seven brand new NutriBullets in boxes in a cupboard. Because I turn up with a NutriBullet, and she goes, "I don't want one of them." We got open it up. We got seven of them, brand new. Because in my head, I've got to do something.
The first time it really worked, so you just kept repeating it. Right.
Seventh time, it's like get it smacked over my head. But it was quite interesting. And I'm saying about how she manages it, I suppose. Well, she doesn't manage it, she just directs it. And then I'm quite easy. I go, well, is even interaction with people, if you go into a party thing or a drinks party or whatever it is, I used to do things like go, right, well, I've got to go now. Because I want to go to the toilet. And she goes, no, you don't say that. What you say is, you know, so in simple ways. Or sometimes what I used to do was, really boring people. I used to go, I can't talk to you anymore. It's really boring. I don't like you. You know what I mean? Because those of it, you know, people are chatting to each other, don't they? And they don't really like each other. And I couldn't see the point. And I go, well, I don't like you. I don't want to talk to you. I say, well, you can't actually do that. What you got to do is do this social thing, you know, this cultural thing, which I started doing, and then sometimes a bit dodgy. About a month ago, there's a guy who's he's just painting us. He's quite self-important in the area where we live. So rather than sort of talking to him, I thought, well, I really find him boring to talk to. So when he started to walk over to start talking, I just looked at him and blanked him off, and he sort of got the hint. So I got the bollock in for that, but actually it was worth getting a bollock in from my wife, because he doesn't bother to come up and talk to me anymore now, so which is great. So that's all right. You know,
that's problem solved for next time.
Yeah. And it's so that, if you like, the penalty of getting a bollock in was worth it, because it was quite, you know, it's just a pain in the ass.
So the machine's not firing, or actually not even registering. I presume it was your amygdala response.
Yes.
Not even firing.
It was the machine
to work in.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, and it's quite interesting, because you look at it and you see the neurons creating new passageways, and it's quite interesting to see that. The amygdala just simply doesn't function, which makes so much sense now. So much sense. And do you know what? I quite like it. It's what Dutton said, years ago. He said every psychopath that he's interviewed, from, you know, criminality, you know, sort of upwards, downwards, wherever you want to look at it. There's not one that said they would change the way that they think and they operate. And
why is that then, Andy? What's that there? Is it because you have this fuck it principle of
freedom?
I'm gonna make something happen. I'm just gonna do it, and I'm feeling that progress.
Yeah, it's freedom. It's freedom. It's freedom to just do what you want. You know, there's a freedom. But then the problem, obviously, is people with the people in prison with it, is that they do what they want. You know what I mean? Okay. Whether it's thieving or, you know, assault and all that, or violence, whatever, that sort of stuff. So what it is understanding. And I only understood it because Dutton explained it to me, the analogy of a mixing desk, where you can adjust, functioning psychopaths can adjust the mixing desk of the emotions of the fear and the anger and the commitment and all the different sort of emotions that affect people. Basically, what we can do is functioning ones can adjust to the circumstance and the context, which clearly I could do without knowing it. You know, I didn't realize. And then he explained it, and it actually reinforced the fact that I really like it, because there's a freedom, there is so much optimism that. If you don't grip it, can border on narcissism or arrogance. But so much optimism, as I said before, as a kid, always knew I'll get out of it. Everything I've done Not everything, of course. There's been cock-ups, but the major things in life have always been a success. You know, the fact is, in the military, a success. Got out, then all of a sudden, out of one extreme into another, whether it's book, TV, films, all that sort of stuff. And what happens, same as in the military, the more success you have, you go through a door, a successful door, and there's been another three ready there for you, because everybody wants somebody who's successful. So, like, you have a look at the three doors, and then we're like, fuck it, give it a go, see what happens. Mm. You know what I mean? Whatever it may be, whether it's, I don't know. Again, you know, I've skied to the North Pole, South Pole, I've climbed, it's done that since I've got out. But it's not as if there's this sense for adventure. It's basically somebody will go, do you want to come? And I go, yeah, all right, I'll do that. And then just get on with it and just do it. And again, you know, skiing to the North Pole really is putting one foot in front of the other. You know, just get on with it and you get there and you go, right, we're there. And then come back. You know what I mean?
But you hinted to the fact that you weren't necessarily surrounded by a bunch of other psychopaths.
No.
You, if you had have been able to interpret some of the emotion, you would have seen fear. You would have seen people hesitate and therefore from that cascade, that loss of integrity, firepower and life.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do they cope? How do they cope in that military environment?
Well, in a lot of cases, it's all right. You're certainly at a younger stage. Loads of, you know, young lads. And again, because they, you know, watching TV, playing films, there's a sort of fantasy element to it. Some of that sort of evaporates during the basic training stage. But as soon as they get on operations and the first time they get shot at and have to shoot at someone, which is an unnatural act, some people do like lose it a bit. And that's where that command and that control comes in to try and get them into the... It's very easy, actually, to get 18-year-old, you know, men and women to kill people. It's a very easy system to get people to do that. But actually, it's getting them over that parapet, you know. And once that's done, that's done. That first time is quite sort of scary for people, actually, because all of a sudden they become aware of their own mortality. You know, they're up to their nose in Kevlar and they've got an helmet on and all that sort of stuff, but there's still people getting blown up. So what happens is that they, you know, the reality sort of boom. And actually physically as well, I'm sure it happens in sport where all of a sudden it's really hard for them to hear. It's really, you know, they get narrow focused. All those where the body's just putting all the resources into things that are important, you know, and 9 out of 10 times that's the problem ahead. So let's narrow the focus and look at that. So you're trying to deal with that at the time, which leads to some of those cock-ups that certainly younger people have during that environment. And then when they come back, again, going back into town, so I just tell them, well, it is all right. Of course it's all right. Doesn't matter. You know, if you think everybody was, you know, like, you know, not shitting yourself, you're wrong. Whether that's true or false, doesn't matter. It just makes them feel a lot better. But you can get over it, and many people do. I got a really weird one of these trips I've done in Afghanistan, these advisory trips. I was on a foot patrol, 16-hour assault, so it's parachute regiment patrol. And the patrol medic was a female Fijian from the, you know, medical corps. So they carry the same kit, same weapons, everything, because they're on the foot patrols and all this. So contact started, contact's firefight, contact starts. The patrol start taking rounds. And there was a young lad, first patrol, I don't know, but, you know, young 18-year-old lad. He's on what's called a minimi, which is a small light machine gun. And trying to get the machine gun working, and he's flapping, and he couldn't manipulate it. He, you know, everything was going wrong. The Fijian woman ran over, picked it up, and stood in the and it's a light machine gun. She put it in the shoulder and started firing it and putting the rounds down into the compound where the Taliban were. So this young, like 18-year-old, like felt really sort of embarrassed and showing up and all that sort of stuff. And the patrol commander was excellent afterwards, you know, the parachute regiment corporal. And basically he said, oh, the first tour in Iraq, that's what I've done. Don't worry about it. Oh, you know, wow. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And the Fijian woman was good as well, where she just went, you know, she says, I don't want to do that again. In fact, we all had to start running. because it was only a small battalion that was going to airstrike, going to come in and take the compound out. So we started running, and she had a Walkman with her and put her earbuds in. She's like, oh, fuck that. I don't want to hear any of that. So she just started running with her earbuds in, and we all started legging it. But it was good in a way that the patrol sort of helped him out, actually.
Did you really keep her on? Did you keep her in the squad? Did you keep her with you?
He'd keep her on. Yeah, yeah. He's got no choice. Yeah, he was like, he had no choice. She was the medic, you know. But it's interesting just on that. It's like men and women have been on, like, you know, on combat patrols for years. You know, there's legislation now that they can join what they call T-farms, you know, fighting arms. But they've been part of it for years. But it just hasn't been, you know, some legislation hasn't been there to make it legal.
So, I mean, you started... you mentioned at the start of the conversation about not everybody recognizes that other people actually like to fight.
And yeah.
They get confused by that. They get upset by it. Have you thought about your role? You know, it sounds like a bit of an existential question, but your role to society, besides the fact that, right, I'm into this. This is my kind of thing. Involved in operations and patrols, but have you thought just about the value that you bring to a society, to a group, to a tribe?
Do you know, to the tribe, to the military tribe, yeah, very much so. But even as a young squaddie, there, and I've experienced where there's never been any value given by the real world. So all of a sudden you become even more insular, and it's like, fuck them, you know?
Really?
And what I think what happened was that, you know, soldiers living in garrison towns, and obviously because of, you know, what was going on in Northern Ireland, where soldiers and their families were being killed on the mainland and there was bombing, the military retracted within security sort of, you know, compounds of garrison towns. They weren't public on the street anymore, that, you know, they weren't hitchhiking home at weekends, all that sort of stuff, no uniforms. So what happened is population lost contact with their military. You know, it was your neighbor's next door kid has gone to join the army or the navy or whatever, and that was about it. So there was no sort of emotional connection, even to the point where I, as a 19-year-old, I won one of these decorations called a military medal. So you go and see the Queen, you do, you know, all that sort of stuff, invest that. So off I go, very, very proud day. Next day, I came back to Tidworth, the garrison town where I was based in Hampshire. And I went to the bank. There's only one bank. Every squaddie had to join Lloyd's Bank. So I went to Lloyd's Bank, and it was to get whatever it was, £20 out or whatever it was. This is a garrison town, by the way. And actually what I was, you know, you're lining up and then you get put to the side while more civilians came in to get served. You know, and I think, well, so all of a sudden, 19-year-old, good, you know, just seen the Queen yesterday. Yeah, I got my medal, all that sort of stuff. And then all of a sudden, I want to get some of my own money out of a bank. And I had to wait while 3 or 4 civilians went through. So all of a sudden, there's that even more of an alienation. And then so I really didn't care at all what, if you like, the real world, or good or bad, right, quite frankly. I used to... one of the things that used to happen was, again, as a young soldier, to get what was called the mail train, which was about 1:30 in the morning from Waterloo Station to Andover, which was the nearest station to Tidworth, this military garrison. And so you'd be there in time for the first muster parade, you know, 8:00, all that sort of stuff. You get in. So we'd be at this, there used to be an old caravan selling bacon rolls and cups of tea underneath the bridge at Waterloo Station. And the NE, whatever it was, Northern Ireland or Get Out of Northern Ireland, all these sort of lads. So I used to drive past and throw dog shit at you while you're trying to get this cup of tea. So they added to the alienation. So it actually reinforced more the if you like, the bonding of the military, you know. And it's only as you get older and you understand maybe one of the reasons why that is. Is obviously there was an ideology there about the Northern Ireland situation, which you know, people are always going to react in that way. But it was that point of, well, maybe because we were so isolated and people really didn't understand, and certainly what was going on in Northern Ireland. More soldiers were killed year on year in Northern Ireland than they were in Iraq and Afghanistan. But because it was slow and constant, and nobody really understood that. So what happens is then you become more insular and really like, fuck them. Don't care. Don't care what people think. And I don't care what good we were doing for society, which reinforced the fact is I quite like being in the army because I actually quite liked the fact that people didn't like you or they didn't understand you.
Interesting. Well, I ask the question as much as anything because I think that sport sort of generally is sort of entertainment, but then you sort of think, what's the function? You know, there's an arbitrary game of kicking something about or throwing something about or jumping far. And I try and compute, what was that all about? Why do we get all fussed up about the sport? And I sort of think it's obviously a bit of a metaphor and it's a mimic of our prehistoric past and so on. But I sort of imagine what it would have felt like to be in a tribe. And you're sort of almost thinking you'd probably need a few, for want of a better term, nutters, who'd leave the tribal boundary and go, you know what? I think I can see land over there. I'm going to go and have a look.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and make something to go.
Yeah.
And they don't come back. But you need some people to be able to do that every now and again, in the same way that you would have to have people that would say, they're going to invade us. I'm going to defend. You need these extremes of personality to be able to, for a group to survive.
No, I agree. And you know, and you're looking at even the, you know, the Dunbar theory and all that, you know, the way that even military units are, you know, rifle company, 100 people, you know, and it works to the extent where we had a period in the battalion, again, a sort of young infantry soldier, where even within the military environment, we segregated ourselves, where we all shaved our heads. There was two washing machines for the rifle company that we threw down the stairs because we're going to hand wash everything. And it's like really within that environment. And in fact, the rifle company got split up after about 6 months because it was getting sort of a bit weird. It was a tribe within a tribe. But we felt really, really good about it. Really good. And to the point where other people wanted to join the rifle company. But it was so extreme. Looking back now, it was so extreme. Because even within that environment, it was like, well, fuck them. You know, we're going to do it our own way. And we're a big firm, and we've got guns. So what are you going to do? So there was a bit of that as well. It was quite sort of a bit overboard, actually, you know, thinking about it now. But at the time, it was great. Absolutely great. Even married people started to move back into what are called the lines, you know, the camp. And they go, right, we're moving into the lines. And they went home at weekends because they wanted to be part of this thing, which then really started, even within that environment, became a problem.
So many transferable lessons there about creating a team and sense of unity and belonging. Yeah. Can I just ask you one last question, Andy? I understand that you and school didn't connect. So was it nine schools?
Nine schools.
I'm interested to get just your take on the fact that you're a best-selling author, worldwide recognition for what you've written. And I'm just curious because I know that a lot of teachers actually listen to the podcast. And I wondered if you had a message to go back to make school a little bit more productive, what you would say to your teachers. I'm just curious about that formative part. Yeah. I imagine that it would, perhaps that dysfunction might have helped your military career. But I'm just curious to know what you would say to your teachers if you could have just made it a little bit better for you.
First of all, sorry. it was that point of, to even as a, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 year old, always knew I don't need to go to school. What I want is money. I don't need to go to school. It's a waste of time. It's boring. I don't know. There was corporal punishment at that time. You used to get the cane, go in the book. And I even remember, even as like a 9 year old, saying, you know, you get the cane over the hand, and I set the example within the school, or to the class, or whatever it is. And you know, I didn't realize it was a major deal. Even for the teachers, it was a major deal. You know, most teachers didn't want to be hitting children, you know what I mean? It was like, it was a major deal. But actually what I used to do was the same as when I was a kid that was at home. If you get hit, it's like not showing anything. And actually I just used to put a little step forward and wait for another one, which you're not going to get, you're only getting the one. And also, so there was this like resistance to school. Not only the fact that I didn't see the point of learning, I resented when I was there. And I just hated it even more. So the more that I was at school, the more I hated it. I even hate the smell, you know, of that old Victorian sort of floor polish and boiled cabbage sort of smell, you know, she used to have kitchens in schools and all that. So if I'm going into a school now, even if it's a new school, I still smell it because I don't like them. I don't like schools. I don't think no one should go to school till about 19. They understand the value of education, I think. It's like, you know, just have freedom until then. But that's all I wanted to do. But because I was too confident about everything's going to be all right, you know. And it was when I got in the military, it was then I learned that I had the reading age of a nearly 17 of a 9-year-old, which is key stage two now, I think, which is really in the sort of education parlance now. But because I didn't want an education, I just wanted money. So that's why I landed up in within the boarding school system. But I think to teachers, there was a problem certainly when I was a kid, because there was lots of replacement, I don't know what they're called, replacement teachers, cover teachers. Yeah. So there was never continuity with the teaching staff anyway. God knows why they would want to teach in these schools, because it must be an absolute nightmare for them. You know, they want to do the good, but actually just got loads of kids who don't want to be there anyway. So really, yeah, it's really, really difficult. I think the more approachable teachers were, the worse it was for me, because I just thought, well, they were just weak. They're not gripping me. They're not doing anything, you know. So it was quite a hard one. So the main thing is soy. There was a teacher who used to give me extra milk, used to get the old third of a bottle of milk. The teacher used to give me the leftover milk when I was at primary school, when I was about 5 or 6, which I thought was all right. So I didn't mind going to school when she was. But that was it, purely because I got milk at the end of it. It's crazy, isn't it? Absolutely stupid. Mm. Absolutely stupid. But it's that, I don't know, it's just too cocky, basically, and wanting money and thinking that we don't need an education to get money, and clearly you do.
Yeah. Well, look, fascinating to chat to you. So appreciative of you giving up your time and sharing piercing insights from that front line. But so many actually real transferable lessons that people can reflect on and apply to their own lives, even if it's just getting some emojis all the way through to to how you can actually develop as a team and put a process into place that you can get the debriefing intelligence out of what you're doing. So thank you so much, Andy.
No, pleasure.
Amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really hope you enjoyed this week's conversation. Now, we've got plenty more to come, so if you'd like to support and champion us, then take the time to subscribe and leave a review on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. So in the meantime, have a great week.